right, welcome to the Build Alaska podcast. I'm your host, Xavier Schley, and I'm with
Chris Jensen.
And where do you work?
I work for QAP, Quality Asphalt Paving.
And what do you do there?
I'm a project superintendent.
How long have you been there?
I've been there, this is my fourth season with them. I came up to Alaska, I spent a couple seasons with Granite Construction, and then moved over to Quality Asphalt Paving.
Oh yeah, how long were you with Granite? Did you say a couple of seasons?
Just a couple of seasons.
And did you do the same thing there?
Yes, sir.
Oh. Where'd you come from?
I came from Boise, Idaho.
Oh yeah, what brought you up here?
Adventure and basically met my wife early in high school, and we were born and raised in that area and thought we'd get out and explore, and both our careers could advance up here too. So
you started construction down there. What did you do down there?
I started out as an estimator and project manager and worked my way up all the way to the vice president of the company down there.
How did you get started as an estimator?
So I was going to school for accounting at Boise State, and my uncle was a blade operator for a construction company, for a heavy civil construction company. And the owner, his estimator, left and started his own company. So my uncle said, hey, my nephew, you know, he's a sharp kid.
Mm-hmm. Well, how old did you say you were?
At the time, I was 19.
Uh-huh.
And so I took advantage of it, went and interviewed, and started the next week. And
just worked under somebody to figure it out, or?
Just the owner.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, when I first started, he had about 17 employees. And he set me down in front of a TV with a little VHS player and some instructional videos and a set of plans. And then he just taught me directly himself.
Yeah.
And
at 19, you started.
Yeah.
And so did you finish your degree or just stay doing construction?
Way later in life.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I think it's not odd up here for people to get started that way. At least it wasn't when I was beginning my career, but it seems less and less that model that somebody gets into the business out of construction and gets into estimation. Like you could get into the business as a laborer out of high school, you know?
It was a very unique opportunity. And when I look back on it, I was thrown in the deep end of the pool, and it was sink or swim. And it basically just capitalized on that opportunity.
When you get a kid out of high school, sometimes there's this lag time between when their work life becomes a priority over their social life, you know? And did you recognize the opportunity you had, or was there some growing pains in there?
Yeah, that was, I think a lot of that was instilled as a younger kid too. My family was loggers, and you worked hard. I mean, that's...
A lot of the people I interview have a similar backstory. In that, you know, they worked in a family business and then they went into a union or whatever. And
fortunately, my wife is also, she worked hard.
Even, what does she do?
She's a nurse. Hmm. Even as both of us being younger, we both have always understood the importance of working hard. And it's really rewarding for both of us. I mean, she's climbed the ladder every place she's ever worked. And we carry that over to everything from what we do personally to our work ethic. And hopefully we're passing that down to the people that we meet and run into.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the construction management end of things, I kind of want to talk a little bit about project management or superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference in those two terms? Is there really one?
There isn't really
one. It just depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah, I would say just even in our inner workings of our corporate owner, that just from company to company, you may call one a project manager or one a superintendent. Even in the local industry here between the two big players, they have a little terminology difference. So if I was working at the other one, I'd be considered a project manager. Here, I'm a project superintendent. It's just same functions.
Yeah. So what's a typical day? I guess there probably isn't one, especially this time of year.
Yeah. In Alaska, it's a little unique because we have such a short construction window that we work hard. Like now I'm currently running a project that has daytime hours and then a project that has nighttime hours. So I have two different foremen, two different crews. As far as my duties personally, your project managers, their focus, you know, everybody in the construction, I mean, right now, safety is your first focus. So you really are another pair of eyes when you come out to the job site. And you try to help them through that. And you try to teach your foreman and your crew the reason behind things. Because if you go out there and just say, you have to do this because we're told that we have to do this, then they realize that you don't stand behind it. So you try to, at least I try to.
For the safety of the things.
Yeah, and for anything. If you just say, oh, well, the boss said we had to do this, then you're basically giving that impression that you're only doing it because you were told. So I feel, and I say this to the president of our corporation, the general manager, actually.
Is that John?
Well, John Fugelstadt's the president of Kalaska, but Todd Porter is the general manager of QAP. And I've done some write-ups for him, and my statement is you arm people with knowledge, and it's a powerful thing. And it goes from, you know, here in Alaska we have a lot of flaggers out there, and a lot of times they're younger generation that are just starting in the union. A lot of them that I have go to school. So this is a great summer job for them. They want to learn. And if you just explain to them what's going on down the road, they're able to pass that information on to the public rather than, I don't know, I'm just here.
Yeah, and it's also the difference between, you know, if you hire a laborer, it's the difference between him being good at that one job he's doing that day to a guy that's going to sort of learn more and progress. You're just giving a guy an opportunity to maybe move up in his field, you know?
So I really look at my job as being the teacher. It goes from scheduling to financials, job coordination, job safety. So I like to take and teach that to the individuals out there. So when I get my daily cost report from my engineer and I go out there and I talk to my foreman about it, I don't just say, here, you did good yesterday, or you did bad. I like to say,
and good and bad on a cost report is based on what?
Financial. Like,
no, but I mean, we build out this many hours, but we got this many benchmarks.
Yeah, everything built across your budget, whether it's, you know, equipment, labor, you know, it's all about production.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to have a good cost report, that means you usually beat production or did something with less resources. In Alaska, our resources are our labor is our heaviest resource. Equipment follows right behind. So usually it means that you did better than what was expected with what you had. So instead of just telling your foreman, hey, you had a day in the red or you had a day in the black, it's, hey, this is what we did yesterday, and here's where we capitalized, here's where we didn't, and what can we do today to change that?
You do that daily?
Yeah, that's a daily deal. And it's also something you do with the schedule. I look at my schedule every day and see what impacts the day before had on the next day and how that compounds through the rest of the project. And that is something that your field employees, from your foreman to your laborers to your operators, they're concentrating on that task at hand that you give them. And it's my job to guide them in the future on what that task at hand is going to do to them later in life. And so I'm supposed to see into the future farther than them. You know, I want them to see a day or two ahead, and I need to be looking a week, 2 weeks, a month in advance on how it works, and then share that knowledge to them, saying, hey, what you did yesterday may affect you this way over the next few days, but I'm going to show you what it did to us over the course of the project schedule.
Yeah.
So I think my main focus, you know, above and beyond safety is schedule and cost. And really that's a project manager. That's what they're looking at. And then we're able to be another pair of eyes that's not directly involved on doing a single task and trying to think outside the box on, hey, maybe we try this a little different this way, and doing more of the analyzing side.
So before I came to Anchorage, I worked for Coalaska in Fairbanks for a while. I was their quality control manager for a long, long time. And one of the things I remember about this time of year when I was doing that job was the rest of my life was, you know, like I wasn't going to a wedding in July or whatever. You know what I mean? Like there was just, you never could plan around the job because if paving started at 5 a.m., then you were there at 4:30, you know, and you had to be there because the job depended on it and there were a lot of people, you know. So your life kind of is not necessarily on hold in the summer, but if people are coming to visit Alaska, there's not a lot of chances you're going to go fishing on a Saturday with them or whatever. So how has that affected your family life?
So the majority of my career I spent in the Boise Valley. And yeah, we worked hard, but it was almost year-round.
Yeah.
I mean, we would work 9 to 10 months with our earthwork crews, and we would work 11 months with our utility crews. And you found time to go camping once a month. We came up here to Alaska, and the first summer was a definite shock.
Yeah.
And it really was challenging for my family. And especially my first summer, I got sent out of town. The project that I was down in Inilchik, and even had spotty cell phone service. So it was even tough to communicate. That was very challenging. And we really just had that light, that coming out of the cave moment. And we sat down, my wife and I, and said, you know, if we're going to continue to do this, we have to expect this,
mm-hmm.
and we know it's coming. And I will say one thing that QAP does for me very well is they're very challenging during the summer, but very forgiving during the winter.
Yeah.
And they really give me the time during the winter to be able to do things at home and do that. They really are aware of that. And that's something that all construction companies up here in Alaska have to take into consideration. It's a very challenging workforce. The last few years, I've been in town on some very challenging projects that required us to work 7 days a week and basically not take any holidays but the day of the holiday off. And it is challenging on my personal life, but also to everybody that works with me, my whole crew. I mean,
yeah, come on, does everybody hate each other?
Yeah, and I'm asking them to jump through hoops and go the extra mile, and I'm unable to reward them with time off. We do our best, and we tell people, if you're getting worn down, say something, and we'll get you time off.
Yeah. But nobody wants to be that guy.
No, but they also, they're here in Alaska, and they know it too.
Mm-hmm.
And from our labor force to our operators.
They've all been through it season after season.
They're the same way. After a first season, they realize, now's work time. I will have to sacrifice. And so I have a really great employee. He's a grade checker. Last year, he had a wedding that he needed to go to. He gave me plenty of opportunity. And I told him, get out of here. Go. You have to do that. And I think that's really important. And I think I'll be the one that, as a leader, to sacrifice my time to keep them going. And I know as they grow into the future and become in possibly the position that I'm at, they'll do the same for their employees.
Yeah, and you mentioned working 7 days a week. What I remember about working on a Saturday and working on a Sunday was you're doing the same job, and everyone kind of on the crew is doing the same job, but the environment is different, you know, mm-hmm. to a certain extent. Like the the city around you isn't as busy, and the pit around you may not be as busy and stuff. And so while the workload is the same, the feeling is different, and you just sort of adjust to, well, I know I'm going to be in on Sunday, but it's going to at least be more quiet, you know, or whatever. So you make these little adjustments for that, you know.
Yeah, depending on the area that you're working at, every day, especially Monday through Friday compared to the weekends, brings a different set of challenges or a different atmosphere. It really does. From the amount of commuters,
yeah,
to the area compared to the different type of commuters. There are commuters that during the week, Monday through Friday, it's really, hey, I'm trying to get to work. Don't interrupt my drive. And then on the weekend, it's a lot of times commuters that are going, hey, I'm running over to REI to go shopping or something like that. And there's a little different attitude with the traveling public too, is they tend to be a little more lighthearted on the weekends than,
yeah.
I mean, during the week they're serious. Hey,
and
I'm trying to get to work.
They gotta be somewhere at a certain time.
And yeah. And it's hard to, one of the things that I really try to give myself credit for is construction today is a collaboratory deal. It's collaboration. And before there was two parties involved. It was the owner and the contractor, and it was an us versus them type atmosphere. And now anymore, owners are looking for, it's the owner, the contractor, and the public, and how can we all three work together? And owners are willing to share more information to the contractor and to the public. The contractors are more willing to share information also. And I always envisioned it as the three bubbles of the primary colors. The more you squeeze it together, the more it just has one center bubble with a different color. And I tell you, it makes it 100% easier on your job when the public understands, oh, this is what's going on. This is how long it's going to take them. And in the past, we used to say, oh, we're going to shut this road down for 6 weeks because we can, even though it's only going to take 3 or 4 weeks. Now we try to, you know, give them more accurate information, a little more information, let our guard down a little bit and bring them in. I'm finishing up the Spinard Road project, and one of the things that
that's in my neighborhood, so thanks.
Yeah, one of the things we really appreciated is we had our weekly meeting with the owner and all the parties involved, minus the public. And then we had a biweekly meeting where we opened the door to the public. And if you actually just listen and then explain to them some of the reasons why things are going the way they are, and maybe possibly why you're unable to do what they're asking, because there may be some sort of policy or procedure or law that prevents you to do that, they usually walk away going, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that.
When that project was particularly contentious, you know, from before the construction phase of it.
11
know?
Years to get that thing off the ground.
I got involved with it in 2008 when I moved here, and there had been people that were involved in it from way before then. Mm-hmm. And I went to several public meetings, and I give the Department of Transportation a lot of credit for just sitting through those meetings, because I had trouble with it, you know, like they were frustrating for me. So, yeah, that road looks good too.
We'll be finishing up the landscaping and some of the concrete work. It is going to be beautiful.
Yeah, and the old light poles went down.
Yeah, it is already changed. I drive through there I have all the pictures from the beginning of the job site, and I'm blown away. I'm like, wow.
Well, and I have kids that grew up, like I think we got here when they were two, so I can remember pulling them on my bike to go up to the Bear's Tooth to watch a matinee with them. And, you know, there was no sidewalk or the road just wasn't safe. And, yeah, I'm so happy with the way it turned out.
One of the things in road construction that we get a really black eye for is all we see in the finish and the public, they see the surface. That's your asphalt, your concrete. Spinard was a great example of everything that was underneath the road, from your sewer system to your storm drain systems, everything that carried the dangers away was falling apart.
Yeah, because that's an old road.
Yeah, we found the drainage manholes on that project were cinder block.
Yeah.
And the water line is old, and there are a lot of services that used to be there in the past that we found unexpectedly, and we fixed them while we were there. We also found sewer cribs from way back in the day.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And these are huge structures underground that are failing, and you either take advantage now and fix them, or you wait for a catastrophe. You wait for it to fail.
Well, I've had interviews in this room of people, you know, who are old-time Anchorage people who can talk to me about when the road wasn't there, when it was all still woods, you know, when Anchorage ended at 15th and, you know, so... And actually, having lived in that neighborhood during that construction, in all honesty, and I drive that road at least twice every day, it really wasn't all that impactful to me in the year that it was really heavy, to be honest with you. So, good work.
Yeah, you know, a prime example for some of these projects is we're going along and we had a sewer, there was a sewer manhole, a sanitary sewer manhole that serviced a lot of those restaurants and businesses, and then a ton of houses that was failing, you know, right dead center of Benson in Spinard. And you looked at it as either we close down the intersection for a weekend and we work 24 hours a day to have it back up by Monday and fixed, or you just ignore it and then you have a catastrophe. And then that's an uncontrolled environment then.
Yeah.
We at least, it was controlled. Notices were put out. We had a plan. We were prepared. And those are the things that I was really impressed. That project's a municipality of Anchorage, an MOA project. And I was very impressed with their staff. Due to the contention, they really studied that project left and right and did the best they could with, hey, we understand we're going to find some unforeseens, and we are going to react. We're not going to take 2 days to get back to an answer with you. We everybody in that project knew it was just in time, instant. People had to make decisions on the spot.
Yeah, and from what I remember, this I was in Fairbanks for, but they tried doing a similar thing on a little stretch of Arctic, and it went wrong.
Went very wrong.
Yeah.
So the year before, I did a stretch of Arctic between 36th and Tudor.
Yeah.
And everything was stressed about the prior phase to Arctic.
Yeah, and that phase was like through Northern Lights and Benson and over to Fireweed, right?
So it was very, it was a very hot topic the year before when I was on Arctic, and visits from the mayor, a lot of outreach to the community via... one thing is,
the community councils, I know they
can. Yeah, and then we put it on the radio and we advertise it. We ended up taking a theory of we handed out flyers every week. On one side, it said what we were doing, and on the back side was a Google Earth snapshot and a map with directions of during this work, if you go this way or that way, you'll be less impacted. With the depths of our excavations and just rebuilding the roads, there's no way not to impact the public. So you just try to find ways to help them find the least passive resistance or, you know, the less impactful.
Well, and unlike doing the Seward Highway or the Nilchik or whatever, that area, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of ways around it too, you know, which is nice about maybe an urban project.
Yeah, and you get challenges from Arctic to Spinard where there's no other way in or out to some of these people that live there.
Oh, yeah.
And when you're going 20 feet deep, you know, out in their road, it's tough for them. And there is no easy way. And you just have to communicate with them. And most of the time, they just want to be heard. They just want to say, hey, I'm frustrated right now.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you pass the knowledge down to all the employees, no matter who they meet out in the field, can say, you know what, we'll be here for another 2 days. Then we'll have this out of the way. Or, hey, try going this direction and coming back this direction. and here are our working hours. Here's how you get to this business. Here's their hours, you know, and well, we try to help people get where they need to get.
It gets difficult too, because, you know, you were talking about the challenges of the schedule on your crew. You know, like I've been there, like come the end part of the summer, like everybody's a bit short, and now you're dealing with the public and you're putting in extra work to try and be less impactful. And a lot of times it is or isn't appreciated, you know, like mm-hmm. all of that sort of plays into what it is to be in construction now, mm-hmm. you know, and it used to be, I think I started right out of college, which was in the 90s, you know, and I started in Fairbanks, which is a little different than Anchorage, but it used to be that what it took to be successful in construction from a superintendent's perspective was more the louder you yelled and the harder you could bang on the desk, the more you get what you wanted. But that's something that's changed in our industry.
That's gone.
Yeah.
And when we get to talking a little bit about the CM program and so forth, I'll get into that. But the day of the yeller and screamer, it has gone out the door. And it's not because the public's soft or the employees are soft. It's people are realizing that you show a little respect.
Well, it's not an effective way to
communicate. It isn't. You know? And people used to have that, oh, it used to work in the past. No, it didn't. You think it did because you were that guy.
It just worked for you.
Yeah.
It made you feel better.
Yeah. And when you yelled and screamed at them and you turned and you left, you should hear what they say about you then. Now, when I do have to discipline people and I do have to stand my ground with the public and the owner, and if you do it professionally, it's more impactful. It stings. When I discipline an employee and I sit them down in a calmly manner and I explain to them what they're doing wrong and ask them questions of what they can do better, boy, that resonates in their mind for weeks. If I just go and yell and scream at them, I turn around, they're going to call me names behind my back and they're going to forget about it 10 minutes later.
Yeah.
But if you handle it professionally in the right way, it actually is more effective in it. It's just a better way to do business.
What's been the most positive impact of your job in Alaska on your family?
I will say winters have been pretty neat because, you know, with the way fiscal budgets roll in with the city and the state, you just in the weather, you just can't start a job early.
Yeah.
You have to wait. And then you're in a 5.5 month blitz to get it done. And that's just the way it is. And there is no way around it. But then it starts dying down. So I have about 7 months of true work, you know, a month of prep, 5 months of work out in the field, and then a month of shutdown. And then I have about 5 months where I take the kids to school. I go into the office. Then I'm able to pick them back up from school.
You can plan your work day out. Yeah.
Yeah, and really be a part of helping them with homework.
How many kids do you have?
3. And during the winter when I'm able to, you know, throw a load of laundry in and have dinner ready and stuff, because my wife's a working professional also, and just to see when she comes home and it's just one less thing that she's got to do, because during the summer she's it. I mean, it's she's a strong person for, I mean, it really does hand the family over to her, and she's got a lot of challenges because she has to deal
that
with
schedule
it.
Affects everybody.
I feel that I have to pick up my end, but it's also rewarding on the other end because I feel I actually get to see what's going on, you know, and have the time to do that. So that is rewarding. I also love teaching. I mean, unfortunately, teaching isn't the most lucrative thing to do, but it's something I really enjoy. And up here has really allowed me to spread the knowledge that I've gained throughout my experience to other people. And I get a kick out of that.
We'll dive briefly into the construction management thing. then we'll come back to it. But so for a kid that graduates and gets into the workforce, what's starting salary like for them?
It all depends, because what I want to pass along to kids is there's construction has different paths, mm-hmm. and different opportunities, and not everybody is leave high school and go right into college. And unfortunately, that's the message being sent now.
Oh, yeah.
You have to go to college. You have to go to college. I agree with that. But there's also certain kids that don't need to go to school. They need to get into the industry, as maybe as the apprenticeship through the unions.
Yeah.
Or somehow get in the field.
My problem maybe with the you have to go to college message is it's often couched in you're a smart kid, mm-hmm. so you should go to college. And and then underneath that is you're a smart kid and smart people don't go into the construction
correct field,
you know, which is totally wrong.
It is, and there's different paths to get to the same spot. Some people are ready for the college side right out of high school. Some people like to work in the field and then use that knowledge to get back into education later. Mm-hmm. As you said, Alaska does have a lot of non-conventional students.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. And I know a lot of people that I work with that took the field route right into internship programs, and they're very successful and knowledgeable at what they do. Now, if you, one path is to go into college in the construction management program, work as an intern here or there, and then come out and get hired as an engineer, you really can make anywhere from $50,000 to $70,000 a year right out of college. But I will say that you have to capitalize on the opportunities, kind of like I was faced with. Not everybody is going to graduate with a CM degree and just have a job mm-hmm. at that level. You have to strive to be the top, because old school, you know, you start in the field, you become an maybe as a laborer, then you go up into an operator, yeah. and then you move your way into a foreman and then to a superintendent. It's not that way anymore. There's so much risk and dollars around risk when it comes to policy and procedure and safety that we really do appreciate the knowledge base that the CM program at colleges give you. And they teach you the behind the scenes, how to do a risk analysis, how to associate that with cost. And that's what we're looking for in these engineering positions. And, you know, we may have 25 kids graduate from here, but there only may be 15 opportunities, and then those are interns, and then maybe only 3 or 4 of them really capitalize on that project. So it is a competitive market, and the people, it's the effort and the work ethic and the drive to be one of the best, is these kids can really capitalize on some really great careers here in Alaska, and we really like to hire them.
Yeah. Well, before we leave the project management superintendent kind of job thing, I always ask people the same question at the end. And that's it's some version of what's the weirdest thing you've seen on a job or dug up out of the ground or
I will say a lot of unmentionables that I wouldn't be able to say. Just some crazy things, but so instead of saying that, I will go into some of the most unique things
okay.
that I found. Down in Idaho, we found a wood stave waterline pipe, and I was blown away with how old it was and how it was still working.
Yeah.
And just because in my world, you know, there's metal pipe, concrete pipe, plastic pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Wood pipe carrying water,
yeah,
and it's
under
water
the ground,
tight?
Yeah.
Wow, and I'm drinking that water,
mm-hmm.
right? That was one of the neatest things. I've also been a part of a 40-foot deep excavation for a lift station mm-hmm. for sewer, and when you're standing on top of the ground and you look down 40 feet, it looks deep. But I was able to go down in the hole and look up. And
yeah,
boy, did that shed some light on wow, look at what we're doing. I mean, this is amazing. And the people that are doing it, I mean, it was a little scary.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be down there.
Yeah, and so those are some of the neat things. I've been around all sorts of construction and watched some really neat stuff go on. And I think that is the most rewarding part about being in this industry, is it's always changing. We're always looking for new challenges, and you actually get to see it. My wife gets irritated with me because I can drive down in Boise the whole trip saying, oh man, we did all the pipe to that. Mm-hmm. We poured all the concrete on that. We rebuilt that road.
Yeah.
And almost to the annoying part.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing. And I'll say it here in Alaska. You drive down Spinard, and if you've seen it beforehand to now, you'll never forget that. And I'll remember that forever. Yeah. Every time I drive down that, I will say something. Wow. You know, I remember when we did this back in 2017, 2018.
Yeah. Poor girlfriend knows way more about concrete than she should.
Yeah, right? And but that's one of the neatest things. And old sewer cribs, never seen one in my life until last year. And I ran into 7. So I didn't just get to see one. I ran into 7. And I didn't know, and I've been in the construction for 21 years, and I didn't know what a sewer crib was because I didn't run into those in the Boise Valley. It was here
and
in
they
Alaska.
Were left over from when, before there was sewer through that part of town.
Yeah.
Back when it was cabins and stuff.
Yeah, and it was actually even a crazy way to do a septic system. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen septic systems galore with leach beds.
And those sewer cribs are like where you've got logs kind of
Lincoln
logged on top of one another with space in between them, right?
Yeah, it's actually basically, you could almost look at it as an underground cabin that is holding your sewer and your gray water.
Yeah.
And it is a leach field. It's old school leach field. And now as we put in public sewer systems, you know, they're safer, they're a lot more sanitary. These things were just abandoned and left and paved over.
Yeah.
And
as they decompose too, they fall.
And you know, you're coming along and you see, you know, a 4x4 square sticking up in the ground, and you're like, wow, where's that going? You stick a tape down in there, and your tape goes down 17 feet deep, and you're like, okay, that's interesting. so that was kind of neat. But, construction industry really definitely takes you into some really neat things.
Well, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.